ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Fuel prices can jump overnight, energy policy can shift fast, and the flow-on effects reach everything from households to the wider economy. I'm Carrington Clark, and on ABC Business Daily's Fuelcast, we bring you a quick update on what's happening in fuel, energy, and why it matters. Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, the ABC Business Daily team will bring you the latest in under 10 minutes. Find Fuelcast in the ABC Business Daily feed on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Awabakal and Gadigal people. So I've just had some time off with my family in Queensland, and we spent it in the usual Australian fashion.
What's Australia's favourite holiday? No, it's not a package tour to the Gold Coast or a luxury cruise to a South Pacific island. In fact, the number one choice is camping and caravanning.
Yes, I bundled the entire family into a minivan and drove to the scenic rim. There was only one problem, though.
Camping can mean different things to different people.
For me, camping meant spending an extra $200 on fuel that I wouldn't have had to spend if we went in January. Now, we all know why this is happening.
With the closure of the Strait of Hormuz disrupting supply chains, Australia's already reaching around the world for fuel.
But what's a bit less clear is, where is all that money going? Who gets the extra $200 that I'm spending on fuel? It's not the friendly guy at the petrol station, and it's not even the Australian government. The answer is complicated, but most of it is likely going to the government of Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia has an east-west pipeline that can carry oil to the Red Sea, avoiding the Strait of Hormuz.
Saudi Arabia's government-owned oil company, Saudi Aramco, unlike its Persian Gulf competitors, is able to get its oil out into the global market. That oil is being bought at record prices by Asian oil refineries like the ones in Singapore, where it's turned into diesel, which is then shipped to Australia, trucked to a petrol station, and poured into my minivan while I try to look at anything other than the price on the Bowser. But oil isn't the whole story here.
Not only is oil being disrupted, but we're also seeing a major disruption to gas.
The price of liquefied natural gas, LNG, has doubled since the end of February. Qatar, which is the third largest producer of LNG, has not only found its exports stopped by the Hormuz blockade, but has been caught in the crossfire of the war itself.
Iran targeted Qatari gas infrastructure in retaliation to a strike on its major gas field, wiping out 17% of capacity for up to 5 years.
The only two countries on Earth that produce more LNG than Qatar are the United States and Australia.
With Qatar suspending LNG exports, Australia's gas giants are cashing in.
Looking at this from a purely capitalistic perspective, this should be a golden opportunity. Everybody needs gas. Australia has gas. So is the Australian government going to be able to use that windfall to soften the blow of the energy shock? Well, that's not really how it works here in the lucky country.
Despite the massive increase in Australia's LNG industry, there will be little change in the government's tax take.
It's very clear to me that Australians are not getting a fair return on their gas resources.
Gas policy remains possibly the best example of broken politics and broken policy in Australia's rich repertoire of such things.
So how did we get into this position, where we see very little upside from increased oil and gas prices despite being a massive supplier to the global energy market? I'm Matt Bevan, and this is If You're Listening. The first thing you need to know about this is most of the time, international trade relies on long-term deals rather than everyone scrambling over the top of each other to buy stuff in a panic. It's been this way for a long time. Right back in the 1930s, Australia was also a powerhouse exporter of natural resources. But our most famous product wasn't gas or coal. It was this.
Wool away. That's the shearer's call to his helper. It's heard in thousands of woolsheds when Australia's flocks are shorn.
So what does old-timey wool have to do with our modern-day gas deals? Well, something happened with wool in the 1930s that's kind of shaped basically every trade deal we've struck since then.
Stocks that yield nearly 1,000 million pounds of the finest wool, a quarter of the world's total needs.
In the 30s, Australia had all the ingredients for a massive resources boom, a small local population, and enormous natural resources. The difficulty was in finding a reliable customer to buy those natural resources from us. Previously, our most reliable customer had been these guys.
Here is the Port of London, a symbol of Britain's commercial supremacy and her mastery of the high seas.
The economic relationship was essentially that we sold wool to Britain and then bought it back from them once it had been turned into cardigans, stimulating Britain's manufacturing industry.
To Australia, this great dominion buys enough goods from us yearly to keep 77,000 British workers regularly employed.
But the Great Depression had severely damaged Britain's ability to afford our stuff. Luckily, someone else was ready to step up.
Glistening in the morning sun, Fujiyama, sacred mountain of Japan, towers above the surrounding countryside.
Japan, economically speaking, is almost the exact opposite of Australia. It has almost no natural resources. No coal, no oil, no gas, and very little farmland for food and livestock production. This meant that Japan needed to import all the raw materials it needed to keep the place running. So a trade relationship with a resource-rich country like Australia made a lot of sense for Japan. But Australia was still a fiercely loyal member of the British Empire.
We must go forward with this great empire policy, remembering that we are a great family linked together in a blood brotherhood of loyalty and service.
Plan was hatched. Australia would sell wool to Japan, but not buy anything Japanese in return. Instead, all the proceeds from wool sales would be used to buy British products to stimulate British factories.
Expansion of empire trade means more employment in our factories at home.
The British government convinced Australia that the Japanese had no other option other than to buy Australia's wool, so Japan would be forced to sign the deal. But when Australia approached Japan with this deal, Japan told Australia, very politely, to shove it. Instead, Japan bought more expensive wool from South Africa and New Zealand and launched a program to simply recycle the wool they already owned, bringing in old blankets and clothes for repurposing. They didn't want to sign a one-sided deal and were willing to cop a bit of pain in the short term to make sure they didn't suffer in the long run. This was a massive shock for the Australian government, which had overestimated its leverage and was concerned that this would be catastrophic economically. But then a solution emerged. When Japan suggested it would be keen to buy Australian iron ore and scrap metal instead, the government jumped at the chance.
Japan pays Australia £4 a tonne for it, and it goes to make steel and armaments.
Armaments? In Japan? In the late 1930s? Sounds harmless enough.
In contrast to our own disorder, Japan was bristling, using Australian pig iron to manufacture weapons.
The move was not popular and earned then Prime Minister Robert Menzies an unfortunately catchy nickname.
The waterside workers of Port Kembla had tried to black the export of pig iron to Japan. It was pig iron Bob Menzies who'd forced them to back down.
The public opposition grew so large that eventually the government was forced to cut off Japan's supply of iron ore. It was yet another schmozzle, but it did teach Australia a valuable lesson. Never overestimate how much leverage you have over Japan. By the 1960s, relations were warming and Japanese children were learning to sing Australia's favourite song about sheep theft. World War II was a somewhat distant memory, and both Japan and Australia saw opportunities in restarting their trade relationship.
Japan is a great industrial country. Japan has shown over a long period of years now that she has energy and ability. Her people work hard, her people have vigour.
But the memories of those failed wool and iron deals were still ingrained in the Australian psyche. The government didn't want to end up in another mess like that. So this time, when Japan wanted Australian coal and iron ore, they got a very good deal.
Queensland coal is selling at $13 to $14 a tonne, half as much as an Australian would have to pay for a tonne of household coal.
In fact, the deal was so good that Japan was buying Australian coal for considerably less than the price it was being sold domestically to Australians.
There are many in the industry who think our coal is being sold too cheaply to Japan.
Japan had insisted on locking in long-term contracts for coal supply. The prices were set in stone for decades and couldn't be renegotiated.
Right now, we have the long-term contract, which covers until 1988. The total amount of iron ore to be imported until 1988 is 360 million tonnes.
Australia never seemed to exercise much leverage or try to keep options open to export their commodities to other countries for better prices. So that's how the agreements on coal and iron ore were made. Well, just wait till you hear the deal we struck on supplying natural gas. The deal that has directly put us in the situation we're in today. In the 1970s, Australia made a very profitable discovery.
In the words of the Minister for Mines, exploration of Western Australia's northwest gas shelf has already shown it is a resource to rival that under the North Sea as the richest in the world.
An enormous amount of natural gas was found in the Carnarvon Basin. Reserves that could provide a steady and significant cash flow to Australia for a long time. It was the kind of discovery that makes an old-timey prospector dance up and down.
They found gold at Sutter's Mill! Whoopee!
The only trouble was the reserve was incredibly difficult to access.
Costs to develop the field were expected to run into a staggering $750 million.
At the time, it was set to be the largest engineering project in the world.
These will be mammoth structures, two or three times the height of Perth's biggest office blocks, to reach down into the deep northwest seabed.
And even once you've got the natural gas out of the ground, you need to turn the NG into LNG by liquefying it. That involves freezing it to minus 162 degrees Celsius until it turns into a liquid. Setting up that at an industrial scale is incredibly expensive. It's an enormous investment, and there's no guarantee that it's going to pay off.
From its inception, the Northwest Shelf project has been a major gamble.
All the big dogs bought in. Australian companies Woodside and BHP, and multinationals Chevron, BP and Shell. But who was actually going to buy all the LNG they would be producing? Who would be our reliable customer?
For a while, it looked as if the whole world wanted to buy LNG from Northwest Shelf. But that was in better times. The field has now narrowed down to Japan.
But Japan wasn't going to make this easy. They made it clear they would only sign up if the price was right.
Oh, I don't think you can guarantee anything, but I've no reason to doubt that the Japanese will sign. They're very keen.
Once the final contract was agreed, it locked in the price Japanese companies would be paying for Australian LNG for decades.
I'm delighted to be able to say that the Japanese utilities have indicated to us that they intend to honour their undertaking to purchase LNG gas in the order of $50,000 million over a 20-year period.
This deal meant that no matter what happened, Japan would receive huge amounts of Australian gas at a very cheap price. In order to keep that price low, Australian governments agreed to charge very little in terms of tax or royalties for gas. When the contract signed in the 1980s expired 20 or 30 years later, governments agreed to continue to charge very little in tax and royalties to avoid getting in the way of investment. By the time Australia started challenging Qatar for the title of biggest global LNG supplier around 2020, the benefit each country was getting from their resource was starkly different.
With Qatar in 2021, there'll be about $26 billion in revenues from royalties. The Australian budget report has forecast only less than $1 billion.
Of course, that's just in royalties, direct payments made to the government for extracting a resource. But even when you include all other taxes, the Qatari government is pocketing much more than the Australian government for selling roughly the same amount of gas. So how did this happen? Well, there's a pattern here. Australia finds a resource it can't easily develop alone. Foreign capital investment comes in. In exchange for the investment, we agree to terms that favour the buyer. We tell ourselves it's the best we could do, and we don't want to end up with another wool debacle. Then we spend decades watching someone else get rich from our resources. We make sure we don't tax it too much. We'd hate for anyone to think we're ungrateful for their investment. We did this with coal, we did this with iron ore, and we did it with gas. The only thing that's changed is the scale. So that's basically the simple answer to the question we raised at the beginning of this episode. Australia's tax settings don't capture as much of the industry's revenue as other countries. In comparison with other energy superpowers like Saudi Arabia, Russia, Qatar, and Norway, only a tiny fraction of the revenue of our gas industry flows into government coffers. But that's really only part of the story. Because you might be thinking, okay, well, our share of the revenue might be small, but at least it will bring in more money when the price goes up, right? Well, this isn't the first price spike we've seen this decade. LNG prices began increasing as the world started lifting COVID lockdowns in 2021. And then in early 2022...
After Russia's invasion of Ukraine, countries stopped buying its coal and gas, sending global prices soaring.
If Australian gas companies had been selling their LNG on the spot market, they would have seen their revenues go up by 700% in 18 months. But the gas was being sold, primarily to Japan, at prices that had been agreed to years earlier. So that big spike didn't benefit us as much as other gas-producing countries. So that sucks a bit. Reduced windfall profits from the war. But presumably, the fact that our gas was being sold at a stable price meant it didn't spike for Australian consumers, right?
The cost of gas has soared in recent years due to local and global problems.
Recently, gas prices have more than doubled in WA.
It is ridiculous that Australia, one of the world's biggest gas exporters, is facing a domestic gas price crisis.
The thing is, our exporters might sell a lot of their gas at fixed prices, but Australian consumers buy it at global prices. We had high prices and potential gas shortages because we had long-term contracts to sell our gas to Japan. So we have to buy our gas on the short-term market. But who is supplying gas to the short-term market? Well, you're never going to guess, but one of the key players is Japan.
A significant share of Australian LNG bought by Japanese firms is onsold to third countries.
Japanese energy companies are buying Australian gas at low prices on long-term contracts, storing it, and then, when global prices are high, selling it for a profit on the spot market. Meanwhile, Australians are forced to buy their own gas on that same market at the higher price. We're effectively buying our own gas from Japanese energy companies. How is this allowed? Well, we gave the Japanese companies the option of doing this during the negotiations for the long-term gas contracts. Qatar, our big competitor at the time of those negotiations, refused to sign a contract that would allow Japan to on-sell the gas when spot prices spike. Most of Australia's export contracts were structured around one priority: get it on the ships as fast as possible. There was no serious attempt to retain the ability to respond to market conditions, no requirement to keep gas affordable for Australians, no mechanism to capture windfall profits when prices spiked or when customers resell it for a massive markup. Just here it is, it's yours. Thank you for shopping with us. It's taken a while, but people are starting to notice that this situation might be a little bit cooked.
Now the population has wised up to what's been happening for decades now.
Australia has not been getting a fair return from a substantial asset.
It's not their gas.
It's not the government's gas. It's not the opposition's gas. It's our gas.
A very unlikely coalition of politicians from across the entire political spectrum has decided that it's time we do something about it, including Conservatives like Shadow Minister Andrew Hastie.
I think multinationals and big business in this country have lost their social licence. They've made no effort to recover it. And a lot of Australians feel like the system is rigged against them.
There are increasing calls from across the political spectrum for export taxes on Australian gas. But the government is still in a tricky position. Deals signed long ago may have ensured that we have long-term customers for our resources, but they didn't leave us with very much leverage. Here's the strange thing about this. Australia is a rich country, a very rich country. We have good lives, good hospitals, good schools. We are doing fine. We are rich. We're just not as rich as we could be. We're not Norwegians. And the moment when that matters most is during a crisis like this. We have little leverage over the people we buy our fuel from. No sovereign wealth fund to offset the massive prices we're going to have to pay at the pump. And no real options. We are an energy superpower. But last week, our Prime Minister had to fly to Singapore to ask them nicely to please keep sending us the petrol and diesel they refine for us using Saudi oil. All we could offer in return was a promise to keep exporting LNG to them and to our other customers at the prices we previously agreed to. As if we have any other options. If You're Listening is written by me, Matt Bevan. It's produced by Adair Shepherd and Pat Sunderland. Supervising producer is Kara Jensen-McKinnon. Next week, well, look, honestly, I'm not quite sure what we're going to do next week. It'll be a surprise for all of us. I'll see you then.